Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service, presents part two of WMD, Weapons of Mass Destruction. In this program, the rise of the anti-nuclear movement and its legacy as the world enters a dangerous new arms race. The program is produced and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed."
You know, I remember the first time I went to see Russell in his beautiful house in Wales, Plas Penrhyn. The very first thing that he did was to take me by the arm and push me up some wooden steps that he had built so that I could see out of the window across the estuary on which his house looked out. And on the far side, there was the house of Shelley. And he took great pride in pointing out that that was where the poet lived. And nowadays, thinking all the time about Shelley, because Shelley gave us the answer to full spectrum dominance in his little poem, Ozymandias. Ozymandias was Ramses III, the very cruel Egyptian pharaoh. And Shelley describes finding his ruined statue crumbling across the desert and coming across the plinth which still stood, upon which was written,
"My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair."
My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye powerful, and despair.
Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
And I think that is the normal end of power. It is a blind alley in human evolution.
Shelley's poem resonates for many these days. It's been used to describe both the toppled regime of the Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein and that of American President George W. Bush. The two clashed over the issue of weapons of mass destruction. Iraq stands accused of possessing them against international agreements. America's arsenal of these weapons remains large and is growing, also against international agreements. Some 50 years ago, the British philosopher Bertrand Russell was the first to warn the world of the dangers of nuclear proliferation. Only a handful of men and women understood the implications of a nuclear arms race. The atom bomb had been deployed in Japan with devastating results. And in 1954, the Americans detonated the first hydrogen bomb, a weapon whose destructive power was simply beyond the understanding of most people. Bertrand Russell clearly saw the dangers and decided to raise the alarm. Former colleague Kenneth Coates.
To begin with, he thought that the atom bomb was a terrible thing, but he did not think that it threatened the survival of humanity. But he knew from his scientific experience that the hydrogen bomb was completely, qualitatively different, and that it did threaten the survival of humanity. As you know, the United States detonated the first hydrogen bomb, and I might say that rather rapidly the Russians were able to follow with their prototype more quickly than the military experts in the West believe possible. But even the first bomb was enough to teach Russell that the second bomb was bound to follow, and that before very long, proliferation of these weapons was inevitable. And the thought that two or more countries would develop hydrogen bombs with the intention of possibly using them meant, as far as Russell was concerned, that human survival was in peril. So something had to be done to mobilize a public opinion which was alive to the danger, which was pressing.
Today, the United States stockpile of atomic weapons, which of course increases daily, exceeds by many times the total equivalent of the total of all bombs and all shells that came from every plane and every gun in every theater of war in all of the years of World War II. In size and variety, the development of atomic weapons has been no less remarkable. The development has been such that atomic weapons have virtually achieved conventional status within our armed services. But the dread secret and the fearful engines of atomic might are not ours alone. The secret is also known by the Soviet Union. If, at one time, the United States possessed what might have been called a monopoly of atomic power, that monopoly ceased to exist several years ago. The free world, at least dimly aware of these facts, has naturally embarked on a large program of warning and defense systems. That program will be accelerated and expanded. But let no one think that the expenditure of vast sums for weapons and systems of defense can guarantee absolute safety for the cities and citizens of any nation.
There was a second argument which was very rooted in Russell's experience, which was the argument for world government. And he saw nuclear weapons as being the absolute justification and necessity for international authority. At one time, he thought perhaps the Americans could provide that authority. He became disillusioned with that because of a series of actions by the United States government, both at home and abroad. But he never yielded in the thought that there should be a supranational authority, and that nuclear weapons should not be in the hands of national governments. Russell was far in front of his time, and even today, this argument is not popularly received. I have tried quite hard to suggest reforms in the United Nations which might make it more possible, but it is far in front of what the national states are willing to accept, even in these days.
And back in Russell's day, the Cold War was in full swing. But meanwhile, the idea to warn the world of the nuclear threat was picked up by another group, this time a group of scientists. The Polish nuclear physicist Joseph Rotblat was one of them. He had worked on the first atomic bomb in Los Alamos, New Mexico, up until 1944. He's the only scientist to have resigned from the so-called Manhattan Project due to moral objections. His idea was to bring together scientists from East and West.
The Cold War at that time began, and the Iron Curtain was there, which made it very difficult to communicate. But in the meantime, the initiative was taken up by the British philosopher Bertrand Russell. And then I came in touch with him in 1954. This is a very queer sort of way history works. I decided after the 1945, after the Hiroshima bomb, I decided I will have nothing more to do with nuclear weapons. So much so that I completely changed my line of research, and I went into medical research, mainly trying to apply my knowledge from nuclear physics to the treatment of cancer. But in the course of this, I became interested in the action of radiation. Why should radiation kill cancer? How can I prevent it killing normal cells? On the basis of my knowledge, I came early to the conclusion that the nuclear test could be a hazard to health. And many other people did not believe this. And therefore, from this point of view, I was, at the time, a rebel in the scientific community when I came out to say that there was a danger. Yes. And then Bertrand Russell, he knew about my views. Although he's not a scientist himself, he believed that scientists have a big role to play in this. And he came to the conclusion that it would be a useful thing to get a group of eminent scientists, if possible from both sides of the Iron Curtain, who will appeal to the world to tell them about the dangers about the whole issue.
He chose Nobel Prize winners in the main. I think two of the signatories in the beginning were not Nobel Prize winners, but they were men of very great distinction. And Russell naturally turned first to Einstein because of his preeminence in the field and because of his confidence that Einstein would respond. Now, as you know, there's a story behind that.
The date, which is very important, was the 18th of April, 1955, when Bertrand Russell was flying at the time from Rome to Paris, from one meeting to another, when the captain announced that he just had the news that Einstein had died. And so when Russell heard the news, he was completely shattered because he felt that without Einstein's endorsement, the whole project will collapse. But when he arrived in Paris, he came to his hotel, there was a letter forwarded from London, a letter from Albert Einstein with his signature endorsing the statement. And this is one of the last acts of Einstein's life. It's because of this document became known as the Russell-Einstein Manifesto. And then Russell asked a number of people to sign it. And then eventually 11 altogether people signed it. And this was announced, made public on a special press conference, which was held in London, in Caxton Hall, in July 1955. I was the youngest of all the signatures. This is the reason why I'm still alive, the only one. I remember I was partly involved in the organization, and Russell was somewhat pessimistic whether anybody would be interested in this. So we felt, all right, let's have the conference in the Caxton Hall, but let's take the smallest room, otherwise it will look empty if too few people come. But then during the week, while this is going on, more interest came out. They decided to take the next size room, and so on, until the end, the largest hall was booked for this conference. It was packed with people from press from all over the world.
In the tragic situation which confronts humanity, we feel that scientists should assemble in conference to appraise the perils that have arisen as a result of the development of weapons of mass destruction. We are speaking on this occasion not as members of this or that nation, continent, or creed, but as human beings, members of the species man, whose continued existence is in doubt. The world is full of conflicts. Almost everybody who is politically conscious has strong feelings about one or more of these issues. But we want you, if you can, to set aside such feelings and consider yourselves only as members of a biological species which has had a remarkable history and whose disappearance none of us can desire.
Among the young, of whom I was one in those days, it was an electric message. It carried with astonishing speed. And our generation found itself arguing with very senior people and with very clever people who reflected the old habits of mind about what wars were and about the way in which politics was conducted. And we felt that Russell had opened up a new vista which was both horrific and at the same time inspiring in its challenge, because something had to be done to make the world different. We couldn't go on living in the same way that we had inherited.
Russell says that he writes this manifesto not as a citizen of a nation, a continent, or creed, but as a member of humanity. And yes. Today we speak so easily of global culture and global communities, but was this an unusual sentiment at the time?
I think so. I think that it was not easy for people to think of themselves as part of humanity. You think, what was the world that engendered all these terrible weapons, which also make a terrible investment? They cost millions and millions of dollars or whatever. And that means that the states have to secure vast parts of their national product for an awe-inspiring military purpose. That is not a frame of mind that conduces to thinking much about the broad problems of humankind. I think that Russell made a silent contribution to our development in that his thinking was infectious and it transmitted itself over the years, frequently to people who had no idea who first had uttered the thoughts that they were now speaking.
The manifesto was directed to the public in general, first of all, to tell them, here we have a new situation has arisen. We now find ourselves in an arms race in which nuclear weapons of tremendous destructive power are being built and made ready for use, and explaining what the effects would be if these weapons were used. So the public should be aware of it. And then saying that here then is the problem which we present to you, stark and inescapable. Shall we put an end to the human race, or shall mankind renounce war? In other words, this choice was given. Not just give up nuclear weapons, but give up war altogether. Because even if we manage to get rid of nuclear weapons, and this is very important because they are the immediate danger, even then you cannot ensure the future of mankind, because you cannot forget, you cannot erase from your memories the knowledge of how to make the weapons, and therefore they could be rebuilt in the future. And the only way to ensure that these weapons will not be used to bring an end to the human race would be if we get rid of war altogether. And I wanted to remember this. This was the main message, which is still valid today.
One class of people who were prone to listen were the significant leaders of the military, because they had some direct experience and knowledge. But quite a large proportion of our intelligentsia were very slow to assimilate these messages, because they had no direct experience, and because it was normal to think that you had wars and that they unfolded and then stopped, and that life continued. And the idea that wars in future could carry this dreadful finality was an extraordinarily serious step to take, to understand, to comprehend. And so I think that there was a lot of resistance to the idea that mankind could be eliminated in this kind of war. So many thoughts had to be brought together, and one of the things that Russell did was to begin the discussion, which subsequently burgeoned, to show not only what happened when you had vast explosions and destroyed large cities and wide territories, but what happened in terms of the environmental consequences, the diffusion of radioactivity, the poisoning of the earth, air, sea and atmosphere. These consequences of nuclear exchanges were just not known to people.
We felt it is important to tell the public, but we didn't realize how much interest there would be. Russell himself, even after the conference, he saw so many people, he was still not sure whether it would be taken up. And he felt a bit pessimistic about the outcome, and we were all very surprised. It was taken up really all over the world, and lots of letters came in, not only from scientists, but also from ordinary people.
We have to learn to think in a new way. We have to learn to ask ourselves not what steps can be taken to give military victory to whatever group we prefer, for there no longer are such steps. The question we have to ask ourselves is, what steps can be taken to prevent a military contest of which the issue must be disastrous to all parties?
To an astonishing degree, we still are trapped. Russell was addressing this huge mutation in the power of weaponry. Now, actually, there have been further mutations in the power of weaponry which are absolutely frightening. But we haven't had a Russell who's been able to explain them to new generations. But of course, the other thing which has altered beyond any description is the contestation of power in the world. Throughout Russell's life, you had a bipolar world fundamentally, which was marked out by the Cold War. The imbalance between the United States and its allies on the one side and Russia and its allies on the other side.
On several occasions, at that time we came very close, really, to the end of civilization. Now, this danger, to a certain extent, mitigated with the end of the Cold War. It had one important effect which I didn't foresee, and namely, with the end of the Cold War, the general public began to believe this is also the end of the nuclear threat. We no longer need to worry about this. And this was taken advantage of by a group of hardliners, hawks, in the United States. They've been working for a long time preparing for this, and a completely different approach to the whole nuclear issue. For all these years during the Cold War, we're told the nuclear weapon is a weapon of last resort, to be used only if everything else has been exhausted. And this has changed completely a year ago in the Bush policy nuclear posture review, which came out in January last year. They declared that nuclear weapons nowadays should be treated like any other weapon in the military's armory. In other words, if you have a war, you use weapons, you can use any weapons, including nuclear weapons. This is a very big change, which people don't realize how dramatic a change it is. And moreover, following from this policy, the America is going to develop new weapons because they need them for certain purposes. And if they build new weapons, they have to be tested. Now, we had a moratorium on testing, which the Americans have signed but not ratified, and now they are going to break this moratorium and they are going to test. We'll be starting a new nuclear arms race in future policy. And this is what worries me. This is why I feel the present time is far more dangerous than we had throughout the whole period.
The arms contest is not finished, but it is transformed, and there is absolutely no power on earth that can challenge the United States, which is overwhelmingly more potent than all others. In fact, it also had greater military might than the next 27 countries in the world combined. Now, if that were all, maybe you could live with it easily. But it's not all. The Americans have unfortunately developed with this huge capacity a mentality which is very worrying. And the military doctrine is an official military doctrine. That doctrine is called full-spectrum dominance. That is to say, the capacity to dominate all decisions on earth, air, the seas and space, and also in the world of information. That's a pretty daunting and frightening agenda. And domination is not a healthy instinct in any case. But to have total domination is an ambition which should make people ashamed, not proud. The thing that can keep humanity going for another century is cooperation, not domination.
There lies before us, if we choose, continual progress in happiness, knowledge, and wisdom. Shall we instead choose death? Because we cannot forget our quarrels.
Russell thought that the collision between America and Russia could detonate hydrogen bombs, which could make the planet uninhabitable. That didn't happen, and one of the reasons it didn't happen was that popular concern meant that governments proceeded with a real measure of caution. The one encouraging thing about the situation today is the new birth of popular concern. That is the real reform which makes other things possible. You can't reform the political institutions without a huge popular concern underpinning it. And this is what is perhaps emerging now, when you have millions of people all over Western Europe and across to Turkey, hundreds of thousands of people in Pakistan, and people all over South America, all expressing the same concerns, I feel that maybe this can distill a higher form of wisdom, because amongst those people there are innumerable creative and clever people.
We appeal as human beings do human beings. Remember your humanity and forget the rest. If you can do so, the way lies open to a new paradise. If you cannot, there lies before you the risk of universal death.
It seems to me that domination will not prove to be a permanent feature of our political life. It's not an appealing idea. The example of Russell was that of a teacher. And a teacher can only operate by understanding and sympathising with his pupils. The relationship of power produces only warped individuals and cruelty.
Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
WMD was produced and presented by Michelle Ernsting. Thanks go to Kenneth Coates, chairman of the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation, and Joseph Rotblat, recipient of the 1995 Nobel Peace Prize and emeritus president of Pugwash, a group of influential scholars concerned with reducing the danger of armed conflict. This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.